why did the rise of the non-religious increase so dramatically starting around 1990? That's a question that I don't think a lot of people ask, and we need to ask. There are some other sociologists who have argued that it's political, and I don't find their argument compelling at all. There's something really important that happened in 1989 and 1990 that is the major kind of factor.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. On this episode,
Standard Theory of Secularism.
Luck is merely a statistical positive outcome.
And the Four Horsemen didn't start the fire.
All coming up next. Hello and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Beau Bennett.
I'm Kim Ellington.
And this is another episode of the Humanist Hour. How are you, Kim?
I'm doing well, Beau. What do we have today?
Well, we've got a wonderful, interesting interview with Ryan T. Cragen. He is the Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Tampa. It goes on a little bit long, so let's get right into it.
Welcome, Ryan Cragen.
How you doing, Ryan?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great. How about you?
Wonderful.
Me too. All right. So if I'm sitting next to you in an airport and you're in the mood to talk and I ask you what you do, what would you say?
The easy answer is I'm a college professor. Most people get that. When I say I'm a sociologist, then I see eyes glaze over. People don't know what sociologists do. They know what psychologists do, but not sociologists. So at that point, then I would say, well, I study groups of people, if you will. And then if they keep probing and they're really interested, I might go down the path of saying, well, my area of expertise within the within sociology is the sociology of religion. And I study two groups, Mormons and the non-religious. So those are the two areas of expertise I have in the sociology of religion.
Cool.
That's an interesting choice. What drew you there?
Well, I grew up Mormon, so I'm originally from Utah, not surprisingly. And I was a Mormon missionary, right? Served a mission. But when I went off to graduate school to try and figure out this whole religion thing, I lasted about a year before it was over. I was done. Couldn't be a Mormon anymore. It just didn't work for me. So I retained that interest, and I keep studying Mormonism because I'm very familiar with it, and it fascinates me. But then I kind of turn to studying this new group that I found, which is the non-religious.
Hey, Ryan, did you retain the magic underwear, too?
I didn't. No. I got rid of those. I actually did sell my temple robes. I don't know if you're familiar with temple robes, but I sold those on eBay, which didn't endear me to a lot of people. They were quite upset about that.
Oh, my gosh. You know that's somebody's Halloween costume now, right?
I delight in thinking about that.
So you got a little bit into the difference between sociology and psychology, and I think that's really good because it even took me a while when I was probing for ideas for the dissertation. I kept on kind of leaning over on sociology with some of the ideas that I had, and I kept on having to pull back and just try to keep it to social psychology because there is a kind of that there is that difference, but there's not a heck of a lot of difference when we get into social psychology and sociology. So why don't you take a crack at explaining the difference a little bit more?
Ooh, that's tough. Because you're right, there's a lot of overlap. Yeah. And in fact, I dabble in social psych and even some psych stuff that I do. So generally how I describe it to my students, right, is psychology kind of deals with the individual, more so the individual and their brain and their behavior. And sociology's groups, right? Mm-hmm. So we've scaled up. You've got to have at least multiple people, right? Or at a minimum, the influence of society on the individual. But really, that's more even the domain of social psych, right? So social psych is kind of that intersection between the two, the right. influence of the group on the individual and kind of how they function in there. So society is like big, lots of people, psychs, more individuals, and social psych I see as kind of the area in between. Does that sound right?
It does, yeah. What's also interesting about social psychology is it deals with relationships, and it doesn't have to be groups of people. It could be like one-on-one. Right. It could be two people. But it could also be a relationship with an imaginary being. So like what you imagine and what's going on in your mind. So there is some of that involved in social psychology, which I guess makes it differ a little bit from sociology. And when I think of sociology, I think of a lot of demographic information. For example, whenever we see studies come out on the internet that talks about like the religious group versus non-religious, and I always think sociology rather than social psychology. And basically, that's a lot of the stuff I want to talk about today. So let's just kick it off with some basic demographic questions that I think a lot of people have. And there's a lot of confusion out there because different studies come out all the time showing different results. And if unless you're a scientist, a social scientist, it could be very confusing. So let's start with a question. Are the non-religious growing faster than the religious?
Depends on the context. So again, here's me being a scientist with nuance, but in the US, that's absolutely the case. And in most of the developed world, that's the case. But let's kind of take it in pieces. So in the US, the fastest growing, quote unquote, religious group is the non-religious. They're growing way faster than everybody else. And we can give some numbers just to put this into context. In 1990, about 7% of the U.S. adult population said that they were non-religious. As of today, our best estimate, because the latest polling numbers are about a year old now, is somewhere between about 21 and 23% of the population now identify as non-religious. So that's it's a tripling, basically, since 1990. And what you've seen with lots of other groups, even, say, Southern Baptists, who are the third largest, if you will, denomination in the U.S., they're actually losing members in both absolute terms, so the number of people is going down, and as a percentage of the population. Catholics are holding kind of steady at around 23 to 24% of the population. It's immigration from Latin America that has actually kept Catholics where they are. If it wasn't for the immigration from Latin America, Catholics would have been losing members for the last 20 years.
I did not know that.
So, so there's just kind of subtle nuances here. But again, in the U.S., the non-religious are growing faster than everybody else, and probably in the next 5 to 10 years will outpace Catholics. So there will be more non-religious people than any other religious denomination in the U.S.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't different studies define the term non-religious, non-believer differently depending on, of course, who's conducting the study? For example, there are many terms that are used, but they don't all exactly mean the same thing. And that causes a lot of confusion for a lot of people, especially people in our community.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are lots of ways to define these things. I think we've probably, for most of the big polling outfits, so the General Social Survey, which is run out of the National Opinion Research Center in Chicago, and say Pew, I think we've kind of arrived at a rough consensus, which is we allow people to self-identify, right? That's almost always been the case. And the question that they get asked is, what is your religion, if any? And if they don't choose one, or say none, or say nothing in particular, then they get classified as non-religious. So what we mean by non-religious is really just that they don't report a religious affiliation. That's all we mean. There's nothing beyond that other than when you ask them their religion, they say, I don't have one.
Right. And I think
so that... I think we've arrived at that consensus.
And I think it's very important for people to understand that this is not the same as atheism. Atheism is very different. It's when you say, I do not believe in any God. That is generally an atheist. When people say they're non-religious, they could be spiritual, they could believe in a God, but just not identify with any particular religion. And I think a lot of times the atheist community likes to jump on that non-religious figure and say, look, there's 25% atheists out there. But that's not technically the case.
No, not remotely the case.
Yeah.
I get quite upset when I see those things. Because again, this is what I do, right? So it's safe to say there 21 to 23% of the population are non-religious. But of those, not even all the non-religious are atheists, agnostics, etc. So it's about 20% are actually theists who are believers, right? They actually believe in some god of some sort. A substantial proportion are kind of deists or agnostics. Maybe they believe in a higher power. They're not sure. And maybe 15 to 20% of them are atheists. It's not a sizable number. We don't actually have... we have okay estimates of the percentage of the population, again, U.S. adult population who are atheists, but the range is kind of big. And the reason I say that is it depends on the survey and depends on the year of the survey. I think our current best estimate is somewhere between 3 and 7% of the population, again, adults, non-institutionalized in the U.S., are atheists, which is still a lot of people. I mean, that's more than Mormons and Jews combined, right? So there are a lot of atheists in the U.S., but that's not anywhere close to the 21 to 23% non-religious.
Sure, sure.
Back last year at the American Humanist Association meeting, I interviewed Dr. Juhem Navarro-Rivera, and he was talking about the Hispanic population and how their youth, their 18 to 25, are actually becoming less religious. And, of course, that's different than the ones that are immigrating in, because most of them are the ones that were born here. But it's just interesting that the population, that the Catholic population is where it is right now with the constant flux. And gosh, I don't even know how you would go about trying to keep track of that. It's a lot of folks.
It is a lot of folks. I know Juhem. Juhem's a friend of mine. And in fact, he's probably done more for understanding kind of Hispanic religiosity and non-religiosity in the U.S. than a lot of people. But that's absolutely true. What makes that really fascinating with the growth of the non-religious, in the 1990s when that really took off, it seemed like it was primarily happening among whites in the U.S. But since about 2000, we've seen that that trend is actually filtering into almost all ethnic and racial groups. The one exception that I've seen is Native Americans, but they're a tiny population, and I mean, they're less than 1% of the population. So unless you have huge numbers, you're not going to get really good, accurate kind of information about them. But among blacks and Hispanics in the U.S., and Asians, all of them are actually becoming increasingly non-religious in the U.S.
Interesting.
Except the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, got to work on that one.
Oh, my goodness.
You've probably heard of the term apatheist before.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who doesn't care about religion. Is there any demographics on that? Because I would think that's a sizable chunk of people in the United States who just don't even think about it. And if given 5 minutes with an atheist, they would probably say, yeah, well, I guess I'm an atheist. Like, they just don't care about it. Is there any research on that group?
Not really. But no, I mean, I know the term. My wife considers herself an apatheist. Like, she just doesn't care about these questions, right? They're just not important to her. So I get the term, and I think increasingly people are picking up on the term. But to date, I have not seen any surveys that actually ask something specific to, like, apatheists.
Yeah.
The closest we could come to, though, would be something like asking how important is religion in your life?
Yeah.
Which I think would be close to that. And the percentage in the U.S. who are saying religion is not very important or not at all important is going up. So that would be a good illustration. The example that I like to give, though, to kind of illustrate this is, okay, so let's say 21 to 23% of the population are not religious. Usually you have to throw in another 5% who don't answer the question, right? So that brings us up to almost 30% of people in the U.S. We either don't know or they're not religious, which leaves us at just over 70% who say they are religious.
Mm-hmm.
But what percentage of people actually attend religious services on a weekly basis, right? Mm. So it's kind of hitting this middle area where we've got those who say they're religious and they actually go. Those who say they're religious, but they rarely go, right? And then clearly the non-religious who most of them don't attend, actually.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Kim Ellington, and we're speaking with Ryan Cragen about sociology of religion.
And it turns out, do you guys know the percentage of Americans who attend religious services weekly? Do you want to guess?
14%.
Oh, you're on the low end. It's actually close to about 20%,
okay,
based on our best data, right? About 20%.
20% of religious people or 20% of overall?
Of the whole population.
Whole population.
Whole population, right? So if we take, and you can do the math if you want, right? But if you take the 70% who say they're religious, that's 70% of the whole population, but just 20% of the whole population are actually attending, that leaves us about 50% of the population who say, oh, I'm religious, but they go to church less than once a month. Mm-hmm. What are those people, right? That's kind of getting at your question. Are they apatheists? Do they not care? Is religion important to them, but they can't go? I think they're probably closer to the apathy. Not full-on apatheist, like I don't care about God, but religion just doesn't matter that much to them.
Okay. And there's also that category culturally religious. And mm-hmm. I would say this is what I probably was right after high school all the way up until, I don't know, about 10 years ago. if somebody asked me what religion I was, I would probably say I was a Christian, or I was Christian or Catholic or something. But I never went to church. I never even thought about God, really, besides if somebody said, do you believe in God? Yeah, I guess I do. And that would be the end of it. I was more of a cultural Christian or cultural Catholic. Is there any data on that group?
These numbers are a little bit tricky, and I don't necessarily agree with them 100%, but I like the researchers. This is Joseph Baker Buster Smith. Sorry, just blanked on his name. They just came out with a book that's a really good book, actually. I would strongly recommend it. It's called American Secularism, Cultural Contours of Non-Religious Belief Systems. And they're using really good data sets, and the numbers they come out with are a little bit tricky, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily agree with them 100%, but they've got non-affiliated believers at 11% of the U.S. population, agnostics at 6%, atheists at 3%, culturally religious, which would be very much the category you described, at 8%, and then actively religious at 72%. And the actively religious, I think, is probably an exaggeration, because again, most of those people are not attending on a weekly basis. Yeah. But that's one that tries to capture that idea of culturally religious. And they actually, what they do in the book is they group those first four categories that I listed, non-affiliated believers, agnostics, atheists, and culturally religious. They consider them all secular. And that puts the secular population in the U.S. at about 28% of the population.
Huh, okay. You would think that there would just be one simple question, like, do you believe in a God? And that because these titles, they're just so confusing. And I don't think everybody knows what an atheist is, and agnostic, and culturally Christian, or whatever. I mean, these titles could get really confusing. But if you just ask somebody flat out, do you believe in a God? That would give us a more accurate number of the atheists in the country, would it not?
Yeah, and we do ask that question, right? So that's in the General Social Survey and in most Pew surveys and Gallup surveys. And that's where we get the 3-7% of the population are atheists.
They're not identifying as atheists, but the survey people are actually interpreting that from the responses of saying, I do not believe in a God.
Yeah, so this is another one that's really tricky. I mean, we're getting into some finer points of survey research. So when you ask the question, what is your religion, if any, atheism is not a religion, right? Mm. Now, about 1% of the population actually say atheist when you ask what is your religion, if any. Mm. But that's problematic, right? Because that's actually not a religion. An agnostic, almost nobody says that is their religion. And right. Humanist is virtually zero.
Right.
So the problem is you're asking a question about religious affiliation. Atheism is not a religious affiliation. So you actually have to ask at least another question to get at the percentage who are atheists. And this is just kind of a fun like side point, but 30% of the atheists, the non-believers in a higher power in the U.S., report a religious affiliation, right? So when you ask the first question, do you have a religious affiliation, or what is your religious affiliation? They say, oh, I'm Catholic, or I'm some Protestant, whatever. And then later in the survey, if you ask them, so regarding your belief in God, do you believe or do you not believe in a God? Do you believe, in a higher power, et cetera, et cetera? About 30% of those who say, I don't believe in a God, actually say, I have a religious affiliation.
Wow.
Which is kind of interesting. 60% of the atheists in the U.S. are non-affiliated. 30% are affiliated.
Well, that might go into this whole cultural idea, culturally Christian, culturally
yes.
Jewish, or whatever.
Well, and often they're culturally Jewish, or they're married to somebody who has them go to church, those kinds of things.
Right,
but it gets back to something that we do in sociology, and we've known it for 50 years or so, that religion is multidimensional, right? So you can't just ask one question and think that you've captured somebody's religiosity.
Right.
1% of atheists in the U.S. are in church every week, right? So that's tricky. Right. If you just asked about belief in God, you would miss these other ideas about attendance, or whether they give money to religions, or whether they, volunteer with religious groups. You have to ask a battery of questions to get at somebody's religiosity.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, before we get into some of the more demographic questions, I need to ask you, as somebody mm-hmm. who teaches at a university, how do you handle your public atheism?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah. Up until literally this academic year, I haven't outed myself in my classes, right? And amazingly, I don't know if I would have done this when I was in college, right? Mm-hmm. But I think I would have Googled my professors. I think I would have done that, right? Yeah. Just to see like, oh, who's going to be teaching me? College students don't, right? Like they really don't Google them. And if you Google me, you know, the very first page that pops up is my professional website. And it takes 2 seconds to see some of the books that I've written, right? How to Defeat Religion in 10 Easy Steps. Like that's right. A dead giveaway of where I am, right? But they don't know. They literally have no idea. So they'll walk into my class, and the way that I try and teach, particularly my sociology of religion class, is I don't try and be hypercritical of religion. I mean, there are times when we can be, but you don't have to be. Hmm. And so I don't want them to come out of the class going, "Oh, Craig, and he's an atheist, and you know, all he did is trash religion the whole class." They don't ever say that, right? But now, as of this year, I don't think I can hide it anymore. So I will say, and I don't kind of out and out say I'm an atheist. I'll have them go around the room the first day of class and introduce themselves and say, you know, what's your religious background in particular? And then I'll tell them, because I tell a lot of stories about being a Mormon. Mm-hmm. I've got gobs of stories about being a Mormon missionary. And I can't tell those stories unless I out myself as having been Mormon.
Of course.
So mm-hmm. I tell them I used to be Mormon and now I'm not religious. And I just kind of leave it at that and I don't make a big deal out of it. And then it kind of just moves on. And as far as like other faculty, I mean, most of the other faculty are non-religious. It's never been a big deal. Yeah, so that's not a concern with the other faculty. It's just with students, I try and be really careful, but I don't hide it now. I used to hide it, but I really don't.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right, well, let's go on to the next question I had about some of the demographic information. Why are people leaving religion today?
Great question. I don't think there's a simple answer for that. I think there are some simpler answers, but I don't think that there's like one absolute explanation for that. I think there are a couple of things. One thing that I've written about, and I've got some stuff coming out on this, but just kind of, again, thinking as a sociologist, I'm going to give a little bit of a context, and then I'll give some specifics. So why did the rise of the non-religious increase so dramatically starting around 1990? That's a question that I don't think a lot of people ask, and we need to ask. Mm-hmm. There are some other sociologists who have argued that it's political, and I don't find their argument compelling at all. There's something really important that happened in 1989 and 1990 that is the major kind of factor, and that's the end of the Cold War, right? The Soviet Union collapsed in 1989. Why is that a big deal? Well, between the end of World War II and the collapse of the Soviet Union, we were engaged in a Cold War with the Soviet Union that was really a battle over ideology, not so much like a physical battle, even though we had some of those physical battles. And that ideology was obviously communism versus capitalism, but to strengthen our identity as Americans, we used religion. Mm-hmm. And we called the communists godless communists. Well, if we're going to contrast godless communists with something Americans, right, then it's got to be religious Americans. And that's the time period in the 1950s when we put In God We Trust on our money, we put Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and we highly emphasize the importance of being religious. Come 1990, when the Cold War is over, that connection between being godless and a communist disappears. Huh. And you can actually see this in the data, which is really cool. I've shown this in a couple of different studies that our Americans still don't like communists, right? Like communism is really bad. We don't like communists, but our attitudes towards non-believers have softened over the last 25 years or so. I mean, they're obviously not great. I mean, and we can talk about those numbers as well, but they've gotten a lot better than where they were 25 years ago. So I think the first big kind of thing, which again, thinking sociologically, is we had to cross that period of time where calling yourself godless immediately brought to mind in people's minds, oh, well, you must be a communist. You are anti-American. You're not patriotic. That ended roughly 1990. And so what I think actually happened is the rapid rise of the non-religious was kind of like all the people who wanted to be non-religious before that point, who weren't really going to church, who didn't care about it, finally they could admit it.
Mm.
So that I think that was the first big push, right? And now I think you're seeing other things that are driving people out of religion. But we really had to have kind of the end of the Cold War to make it acceptable to be non-religious in the U.S. And now there are other things that are driving it. So does that make sense, that first part?
Yeah, it certainly does. And I'm thinking about this from a psychological perspective. I'm thinking about what's going on in the minds of the people pre-1990. That were they, like you suggested, were they kind of pretending because they didn't want to come out as an atheist, so it was socially unacceptable, so they're just kind of in the closet more? Or maybe they did believe, but they didn't have enough desire, perhaps, to look into the whole issue of God and to explore atheism and to actually say, okay, yeah, maybe I'm an atheist. They didn't have that motivation because if they did come out as an atheist, well, they'd be part of the socially unacceptable group.
Yeah. So, and it could be both. I mean, I don't think we have really good, you know, evidence on that, but I think it's pretty clear that that timeline, and you see when you look at the numbers, right? End of the Cold War and suddenly the rise of the non-religious just shoots up, right? It doubles between 1990 and 2001 from 7% to 14%. It's just rapid. And I think there are other factors that are going on. We have a rapid economic expansion, and we have the rise of the internet, which I don't think the internet was actually that big of a deal because the expansion started earlier. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are lots of things that contribute to this. As far as what's continuing to drive it, if we go into kind of big classic theories, secularization is the standard theory that explains the rise of non-religious people, and it's driven by modernization, right?
Right.
So that's kind of the big theoretical argument. What do we mean by that? Well, modern ways of thinking, which would include things like democracy and equality and universal human rights and rationality, all of those things kind of lead to a different way of thinking about the world, a modern way of thinking. And that modern way of thinking causes problems for religion. So the example I use in my classes to explain this, I think, works for most people. Most people are familiar with cars, mm-hmm. right? Like, you probably drive. Most people do. And even if you don't drive, you know what it is. But here's where it gets a little fun, right? Do you actually know how a car's engine works?
No.
Right, and that's fine, right? There's nothing wrong with that. Most people don't actually know whether it's, you know, electric or hybrid or an internal combustion engine. They don't know how it works. But if you start having issues with your car, are you going to, I don't know, cut the head off a chicken as part of a magic ritual to bring it back to life? Are you going to anoint it with oil? Are you going to say a prayer? Are you going to do anything to kind of invoke the will of the divine to fix your car? Or are you going to take it to a mechanic?
I choose the latter.
Yeah, I think right? Me too.
Yeah. So, it when I state it that way, it becomes very obvious, like, well, duh, right? I may not know how a car works or a cell phone or a computer, but I know that somebody does. And it's not magic. It's not gremlins or goblins or ghouls or ghosts. It's something, you know, there's science behind it or engineering or whatever it is. But our modern way of thinking causes problems for religion. And good examples of this, right? Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. If we were to drop a car, you know, back in history 1,000 years ago, people would think it was magic. They wouldn't know what caused it, right? But today we just don't think that way. So the kind of the very basic argument behind secularization is that modernization causes problems for religion. We just don't think religiously anymore. We don't invoke the divine to explain most things. Some things we do still do that. Most religious people do. But for basic things, they don't. Does that make sense? So that's our other big argument.
Yes.
It does. I'm thinking, though, I have lots of non-religious friends, and there is a different level of magical thinking that they have. And mm-hmm. it's not just invoking the religion part, but like they don't understand or haven't looked into the science behind just simply like coincidences. They think sure. coincidences are magic, like that something must be behind it. And I love them. And if you're listening, I love you. But coincidences aren't magic. It's statistics. It's numbers. But that kind of thinking, even though it's not cutting a head off a chicken, is still magical thinking. And it's still very pervasive.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually just had a paper come out in a psych journal. So it was a social psych study that we were doing, looking at religious attribution biases. This is why I said, you know, most things. Basically, what we were doing is trying to understand when people invoke the divine in trying to explain unexplained events, right? And what we did is we gave people three vignettes. One was about a woman who survived a car crash and was uninjured, right? Another, she got throat cancer and had surgery and came back with her voice and she was fine. And then a third person lost her keys, right? And then found them. And it turns out atheists don't invoke God for any of those, right? For any of those events, we gave them that option, right? What contributed to them surviving the car crash or surviving cancer or finding their keys? Atheists are like, you know, whatever, not God.
Right.
But for the religious, they really only invoke the divine when it's something life-altering or very serious. So the title of the paper is God May Save Your Life, But You Have to Find Your Own Keys, right? it was a very tiny percentage of people who were like, oh, God helped her find her keys, right?
That's good, yeah.
But when you look at the percentage who, religious people, right? So this is religious people. Most of the believers, the religious people, actually invoke the divine on the woman surviving the car crash and the woman recovering from cancer without losing her voice. So we still do that. Now, flipping that on its head, we were actually also interested in what non-religious people, atheists in this particular case, what they invoke when it comes to explaining these things, right? Because somebody survives a car accident, and it was a very severe, you know, serious car accident. You're absolutely right when you're like, well, it's statistics, right? Like, this is probability. That kind of thing happens. So we gave them that option to say, was this probability or luck, right? And most of the non-religious actually did say that. My co-author, he's also a non-believer, but he's very kind of skeptical in other ways. He actually says, well, how is probability not supernatural thinking too, right? Because basically we can't explain why somebody survives a car accident. It's numbers, right? It's just luck. But what is luck at the end of the day? Is that still kind of supernatural thinking? And I'm actually asking you to, because we raised that in the paper, but he and I debate this all the time.
Oh. Well, I could give you my opinion. Sure. Or view on luck. Luck is just a label that we give to a positive outcome, statistical positive outcome. Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Kim Ellington, and we're speaking with Ryan Cragen about sociology of religion. So in life, of course, statistically, everything's a bell curve. We have the negative outcomes and the positive outcomes. Anything that's on the positive outcome side, we call good luck. Anything on the negative outcome side, we call bad luck.
Bad. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. And I would agree. And we've kind of had these arguments, right? Because just statistically, in the course of a day, right, billions of things are happening because there are billions of people, and some of those things are going to be really unusual, right? They're going to be weird. They're going to be rare because there are so many things happening. And statistically, right, you just described it. It's a probability curve that some of those things are going to be really unusual, and that happens. And I wouldn't call that anything supernatural, but I can't really explain why it happens other than to say, there are lots of things happening. Some of them are going to be unusual.
Well, do you have to explain why they're happening? Because that's kind of getting into determinism and talking mm-hmm. about the positions of every molecule and what's going to happen in nature if we fast forward life and molecules and so forth. I mean, that's kind of a big ask to ask somebody to fully explain probability.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And this is where my buddy and I, we kind of debate it. You know, Jay would say, oh, no, that still seems kind of supernaturalistic. And I'm like, yeah, it's numbers, right? Like, at the end of the day, it's numbers. So we don't necessarily agree. But the fascinating thing is most atheists in our study did invoke probability or luck, right? On both of those. Actually, with the car accident, which was interesting, we gave them another option, which was science and technology, and they weren't mutually exclusive. They could choose as many categories as they want. For both the recovery from cancer and the car accident, they were more likely to invoke science, technology, probability, and luck. So they were giving more naturalistic explanations or probabilistic explanations, whereas the religious were invoking the divine.
And I did have a quick question following up on why do people leave religions. You said there was a big change from 1990. Was this like a straight change or is it kind of like a curve? Because I'm wondering if there was a big jump in 2001 after the Twin Towers incident. And also around there is when the Four Horsemen came out with their books and started publicly touting atheism. Did we see any kind of big jump around that period?
No, which is a great question. Turns out 2001, the September 11th attacks, and this is good social psych research, right? When people are attacked, they become more conservative. We actually saw a bump the other way. People went back to church. It lasted about 6 months is all. But we did see a little bit of a bump of people becoming more religious as a result of September 11th, because we were attacked, right? But that only lasted a few months, and then people went right back to kind of the same pattern. I would be reticent to say that it's like a linear trend, though the numbers right now do suggest it is. But it's kind of, I don't want to come out right publicly and be like, oh, it's a linear trend, and the numbers are going to continue at the exact same rate.
Of course,
we don't know that, right? But basically, since 1990. All the way up through 2001, there was a little bit of a slowdown in 2001 because of the September 11th attacks, but it's continued straight through there. And I would actually probably say that the new atheists, if you want to call them that, right, the Four Horsemen, they didn't start this phenomenon. They jumped in when it was already happening, which is great. Like, I'm not criticizing them at any level. I'm just saying there's no evidence that what they did actually accelerated the trend. The trend was already well underway when they popped into the scene.
Interesting.
And I think that's part of the reason why they actually did so well is because there was a lot of interest right at that time. A lot of people were leaving. If they did anything, and the numbers are too small to measure it, it might have been slightly increased the number of people who are openly saying that they're atheists, right? But I don't think anybody's got sufficient data to actually make that argument.
Right. It's like when I started my web hosting company back in 1995. I didn't invent the internet. Al Gore did. But I capitalized on it at the right time.
Right. Exactly.
All right. So the next question, these are just three questions I'll put all together in one, and we'll talk about the research. Are religious people happier, less intelligent, or are they more generous?
Great questions. And again, I'm giving lots of nuance here. On the first one, happier. There have been a number of studies over the last 30 years or so, mostly by religious scholars, right, who have found, in the U.S., religious people tend to be slightly, and when we say slightly, I mean, we're talking really small percentages here, right? Mm-hmm. But with a big enough sample, if you understand statistics, a big enough sample, you can find very small differences are statistically significant.
P-hacking.
So that's true, right? They did find that all the way up until basically the last 5 or so years, they've been finding that pattern. This is a great place to pop outside of the U.S. and go to other countries, right? Because when you step outside of the U.S., which still has, even though, in 1990, I think the culture changed a little bit, it still has a pro-religious culture. Mm-hmm. We value religion in the U.S. We expect people to be religious. If you go to countries where that's not the case, that relationship between religiosity and happiness completely disappears or sometimes even reverses itself.
Right.
So if you go outside of the U.S. to Western Europe or even like Australia, New Zealand, Japan, different places that are far more secular than we are and where religion isn't as valued, there's no difference between being religious and non-religious, or even in some cases it reverses. So what we're finding is that tiny difference that sometimes you find in surveys where the religious are a little bit happier than the non-religious, it disappears once the pro-religiosity of a country is taken into account.
Great. And there's two points that I want to emphasize that you made. One was this idea of effect size. A lot of people who don't deal with statistics aren't sure about this. They just look at the p-value or significant. The report will say it's significant result, so they'll say, "Ooh, wow, that's a lot." But as you mentioned, if you're playing around with the sample size, you could basically get anything significant. So what you have to look at more closely is the effect size. And what we see, we don't see a huge effect size in this right. area. And I'm not sure you talked about this, but mm-hmm. the idea of, I guess this is more from a social psychology perspective. What we're talking about here is in-groups and out-groups. If you are yeah. part of the in-group, and here in the United States, the in-group comprises religions. So if you're part mm-hmm. of the in-group, you feel more accepted, you feel better socially, and your well-being increases for that reason. But if you see yourself as part of the out-group, and especially if you don't have that social support that a lot of people have, like listening to this podcast or having the atheist community, like online communities or families or so forth, then you see yourself as part of this out-group and your level of well-being decreases. And what we see in countries like Iceland or a lot of the Scandinavian countries, we see the in-group is actually the non-religious and the out-group is actually the religious. So we see that slight reversing.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, this is a very good discussion. One point, and just trying to be fair here, right? Right now, the religious groups in the U.S. don't include Muslims. They're definitely an out-group. And you can see that in their subjective well-being as well, right? That yeah. they report lower levels of happiness because they're discriminated against right now, in particular, more so than even atheists. So, you know, there are in-groups and out-groups, absolutely what you described, and that doesn't always include all religious groups. Muslims right, are right. in an out-group right now.
That's an interesting point because it also is important on how people identify and how people see themselves as what part of a group. If a Muslim sees him or herself as a Muslim, then as part of like the small out-group, then yes, then even that perception alone could lead to a lower level of well-being. However, if they see themselves as part of this larger group of God-believing, God-fearing people in the United States, mm-hmm. then if they capture that identity, they could increase their well-being. So it really depends on what group you actually yep. choose to define yourself with and see yourself
Absolutely.
As being part of it.
Other points on the happiness question?
No, that's it. Let's move to intelligence.
There are, and this is mostly psych research, right? There have been a couple of more sociological studies, but almost all of them have been psych researchers looking at the question of who's smarter.
Right.
The positive news is atheists do win on this one, right? But notice my wording very carefully. I said atheists, I didn't say the non-religious. Mm-hmm. Turns out there's no evidence that non-religious people in general are smarter, scoring higher in IQ tests, right, than religious people. That used to be the case when the non-religious were a smaller percentage of the population, but today that's not the case. There's no evidence for that. And again, just putting lots of caveats in here, not everybody agrees with IQ tests as a great measure of intelligence, but that's usually the test Sure. that's being used here. Is IQ tests.
And that's what I was just going to ask you. There's a lot of. Sorry, there's a lot of. I've read two studies. No, not the actual studies, but in the layperson's
summaries
of them. Yeah, that the IQ test was even originally. It was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was developed to find low IQ and has kind of been misused over the years, and it's been changed. Gets changed pretty regularly. Isn't that correct? Like the mean
yeah.
it becomes. So how is that?
Well, they adjust the
How
mean.
Is that? Right. So if you have to continually adjust something that wasn't created for that in the first place, is it an accurate representation to use for these kind of studies? Or do we just do it because it's all we have?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those situations, right, where it's like we don't have anything really better. Occasionally, you'll see people try and use a proxy like, oh, well, the smartest people have to be scientists, right? So who are our professors at top universities, and are they less religious? And yes, they are, right? But do we have, like, the perfect measure of IQ? I don't think we do. And so I absolutely want that caveat in there, right? Like, I don't know that we've got the perfect measure of intelligence. But using the measures we have, which are flawed and problematic in lots of ways, atheists end up scoring higher in IQ, right? And I do like, kind of, again, another caveat. What's the causal direction there, right? We don't know that for sure, right? Are really intelligent people more likely to leave religion? Or, could there be something else going on that, because I guess the reason why atheists like hearing, oh, you know, we're smarter, is because it makes it seem as though they left religion because they thought their way out of religion. And I don't actually think that's the case for most non-religious people.
Right.
I actually think most non-religious people leave either because they're disinterested or because most of their social network already left and they have connections out of religion. I don't think it's that most people think their way out of religion, but that's why we kind of like hearing, oh, atheists are smarter, right? Well, you know, they are, fine, using those flawed measures. But does that actually mean that people are thinking their way out of religion?
Right.
I don't think most do.
Right.
Yeah. I don't, and I've definitely, and again, I'm just one person, I'm not trying to play that, but I don't like that. I don't like atheists thinking that they're smarter, and I think it's not a good idea for people in general, because there's, like you said, there's so many other ways that it could be measured that we're not using, and yeah, it's just not a kind way or even accurate way to go about thinking. Well, as a worldview.
Right. Well, when you say accurate and you say kind, I think that's two different things. And this is one issue I always had a problem with. When we're talking about stereotypes, and that's a lot of what I study, stereotypes. Stereotypes are real, and they are helpful in the world, and they are accurate very often. For example, like if the statistics and the data show that atheists as a group are smarter than theists as a group, then that's a fact. I mean, that's just the way it is. Now, if I go around as an atheist saying I'm smarter than you, then I'm just an idiot, right? I'm just a jerk.
But ecological fallacy.
Yeah, but because it doesn't mean, and that's another point, I'm an individual. I'm an individual part of the group. When we're talking about statistics and demographics, what we're talking about is the group average. We're not talking about me. I cannot say that I am smarter than every theist. I mean, that would just be completely fallacious and absolutely wrong. And if you look at any group, that's the same thing. You could do the same thing with any groups or any statistics. Statistically speaking, if atheists are smarter as a group, that's all we can say. We can't say that I'm an atheist, therefore I'm smarter than you, Mr. Theist or Miss Theist. It just doesn't work that way. And you're an idiot if you do, and you're a dick if you do, because that's just a dickish thing to say.
Yeah, that's a great way to summarize it, right? So the data are the data, but don't be a dick.
Right. Then we'll leave it at that. All right.
Third point, you had generous.
Yeah. More generous, right.
Okay, this is another one that requires some nuance. Okay, so basically, religious people are far more generous when it comes to giving to religions. Shocker, right? the tricky part is
that generosity.
If you can pull out charitable giving to non-religious entities, then there's either no difference or the non-religious are actually more charitable. But most studies will actually not separate those, right? So they'll actually throw in, hey, all of your charitable giving, you know, let's put it all in a basket. How much do you give to charity per year? Or, you know, how often do you give to charity? And they include religions in there. And the reason why I have a real issue with that particular way of doing things is because when you're giving money to your church, you could make a compelling argument that what you're actually doing is paying your dues instead of actually giving to charity, right? I mean, it's kind of the same. I mean, you could make the argument, right, that for a non-religious people who doesn't have a church but goes to the gym, can we count all of their gym fees as the equivalent of religious people's charitable donations?
Right. Yeah.
Because really, it's the same thing, right? Like, I spend X hours per week in the gym. They spend X hours per week at church. We're both getting supposedly benefits out of this, right? Whatever those benefits are. And we could talk about health issues if you want. But we're both getting benefits. They're just paying their dues one way. I'm paying them another way. But they get to count theirs as charity and I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you pull out non-religious charities, there's either no difference or the non-religious are actually more charitable.
Hmm. All right. Well, before we wrap this up, do you want to quickly tell our listeners about your books that you have available that they might be interested in?
Sure. I can do that. Basically, I hate trying to sell my own books. It's awkward. You can find me online, right? So it's Ryan Cragen. Do a Google search. My website, my professional one, is ryantcragen.com. And on there is listed most of my articles, right? So I publish any article that I've published, I put up there. So there are PDFs of all my articles. And then, of course, there are links to my books. I've got a couple that would be of interest to your listeners. The first one was What You Don't Know About Religion But Should, which came out in 2013. And it goes through a lot of these numbers, right? There are actually chapters in there on intelligence and education and happiness and health and all of those things. And looking at the different differences between the non-religious and different groups of the religious. And it's, you know, it's a quick read. It's meant for a lay audience, so that'd be a fun one. And then my most recent one, which came out last year, is How to Defeat Religion in 10 Easy Steps. And basically, I walk through the social science of what people can do, literally individuals can do, to try and weaken religion in the U.S. Hmm. So, and that's a short read. It's 150 pages or so. It's pretty easy read. It's fun.
Wow. Okay.
And for other listeners, there's some of your articles I just perused real quick. There looks like some really fun things with the religion and sexuality. And they actually looks like you've studied that pretty extensively. Which I hate that we're running out of time and can't talk about it more, because right. I'm going to have to go read all your articles.
Well, please do. My colleague, Jay. Jay is more into the kind of sexualities and gender issues. And working together, basically, we've kind of hit that area pretty strong recently. So it's been fun. Yeah, we've been doing a lot on that.
All right. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. This was a lot of fun for me, especially, and I hope our listeners enjoyed it as well. And one more time, what is your website where people can go?
Sure. RyanTCragun.com. You can find everything there. Just Google me. It'll pop right up. Thanks for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. You bet. Very you take cool. care. All right. So, Kim, did you have fun?
That was amazing. So much good information.
And did you learn? That was the second part of the question. Did you learn, too?
Oh, gosh, yes. And yeah. I'm really excited to go to get that book, actually. I'm fascinated.
All right. Very cool. All right, listeners, if you have any questions about this broadcast or if you have any comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Till next time, I'm Bo Bennett.
I'm Kim Ellington. Thanks, you guys.
Bye-bye, everybody.